It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As part of our ongoing series looking at the year 1963, reporter Chuck Kornbach has been speaking with people who were part of or influenced by the civil rights movement a half century ago.
He's also been talking with those who are taking to the streets today. Here's the first of Chuck's two stories.
The life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation.
When Martin Luther King Jr. spoke those words in 1963, then Milwaukee Common Council member Vel Phillips was already trying to reduce segregation. After all, Phillips says years before, she'd been the victim of housing discrimination.
The real estate people would just say, "Oh, I could not sell you the house because you are a Negro."
Phillips, the first African-American and woman on the Milwaukee Council, eventually won a fair housing ordinance in Milwaukee with help from a federal housing law that passed. She says Dr. King was a good friend, but Phillips contends, at least in 1963, her activism was separate from his.
He was just another person in the movement. I think if I had known that they'd have a Martin Luther King Day, I would have been nicer. But he was a gentleman and a wonderful friend.
Phillips went on to be the first African-American judge in Wisconsin and the first black to be elected to a statewide office, Secretary of State.
Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed.
The words of King and other civil rights leaders helped prompt Reuben Harpole of Milwaukee to become more active. He says his wife, Mildred, also gave him a push.
My wife told me one day in the basement, "You got to go out there and do something." I said, "Do what?" I didn't know what to do.
Harpole was working as advertising and circulation manager for a black newspaper in Milwaukee, so he says he wasn't about to go out and march and make speeches. Instead, Harpole teamed up with some contacts and focused on setting up education programs and scholarships for others.
I was motivated by Dr. King. I met him just before he died. I shook his hand, and I said to him, in my own mind, "Okay, they might get you, but I'll be here."
Harpole did stay here and went on to work for decades at UW-Milwaukee and at a local foundation. While Dr. King motivated many people, he wasn't the only civil rights leader of the time influencing activists.
I'm a Muslim minister, and I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts.
That's Malcolm X delivering part of his famous ballot or the bullet speech. Milwaukee-raised Howard Fuller says he heard a version of the speech in 1964 when he was a graduate student in Cleveland, Ohio.
And he talked a lot, you know, about human rights as opposed to civil rights, actually, and what that meant, and, you know, how we had to begin to see ourselves as people of African descent or as black people.
Fuller went on to become a state cabinet secretary, a county official, head of Milwaukee Public Schools, and now a leading school voucher advocate as a professor at Marquette University.
For me, what it was the need to engage in ongoing struggle so that the poorest of our people would have some dignity and worth. And that's something that has always stuck with me.
Fuller, Reuben Harpole, and Vel Phillips all say some social and economic progress has been made since the days of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. But they also have concerns about what they say are some backward steps as well. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee.
Thanks to Chuck for that story.
The Wisconsin Bicycle Federation is supporting a new bill that would increase the penalties for traffic violations that hurt vulnerable users of Wisconsin's roads.
We'll find out why they think the bill is necessary and what it would change about existing traffic laws. And we'd love to hear from you on this. Are you an avid cyclist? Have you ever had a problem sharing the road with cars? And do you think that tougher penalties are necessary? Why or why not? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@wpr.org.
Dave Cieslewicz joins us now. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Bicycle Federation, former mayor of Madison. Dave, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with the basics. What would this new bill do if it were passed?
Well, essentially, under current law, if you kill or injure a cyclist or a pedestrian or a police officer doing his or her duty, writing a ticket or whatever on the side of the road, or a farmer on his farm vehicle, if you're negligent in driving and you kill or injure that person, if the district attorney cannot prove criminal negligence on your part, and it's difficult to prove, then that district attorney is left with really just a slap on the wrist, a moving violation, a fine that could run $100, $200, $300. And we feel that district attorneys should be given another option. If you are negligent in your driving and that results in the injury or death of another person, a vulnerable user, as we call them, then we want to give that district attorney an option to charge and have a penalty that's commensurate with the crime.
Is this a problem that happens often where there is a fatality of one of these vulnerable users and there isn't a criminal charge available?
Yes, it happens far too often. We had a case just in the last year in Muskego where a young man, a driver, fell asleep at the wheel. He ended up killing a cyclist, and that driver ended up being charged with a moving violation. He paid a $126 fine. Several other cases like that, not just for cyclists, but also for pedestrians and others.
So it seems like this could still be a gray area situation. The driver will claim, say, a bicyclist or pedestrian jumped out in front of them. It's really still going to be hard to prove any kind of criminal negligence, even under this new law, wouldn't it be?
Well, again, you don't. The standard in this law is not criminal negligence. And I also should point out, if the cyclists were in the wrong, then it's very unlikely that a citation would be issued at all to the driver. These are only cases in which a citation is actually issued to the driver.
All right. And there's also, as I understand it, an educational part of the new bill. What's in that?
Yeah, the bill requires that driver's education courses cover needing to be careful and watch out for vulnerable users. It's just a requirement that as part of the driver education curriculum, there is a segment on vulnerable users.
Don't we kind of get a little bit of this? Who has the right of way, the pedestrian or the driver, or is there just not enough material?
There really isn't enough, and we feel that there, with so many more people riding their bikes today and so many more pedestrians, which is, of course, a good thing, we think it's important that that be emphasized just a bit more in driver education. Our point is that, look, I'm both a driver and a cyclist and a pedestrian. But the truth is, if I hit your car with my bicycle, I'm going to do some pretty serious damage to my bike and to myself. If I hit a cyclist with my car, I could very well seriously injure or kill that person. So when you're driving a car, you're in command of deadly force, and with that needs to come some responsibilities, and we just think that needs to be underscored in driver education courses.
And what are the penalties that someone could face in these situations specifically? How much of a fine? What else could they get?
Sure. Well, let's take, for example, inattentive driving. Right now, if you were cited for inattentive driving and you had killed a cyclist because of it, you could be charged a fine as little as $20. Under this bill, all fines double if bodily harm is involved. But if there's a death, you could be charged with a Class A misdemeanor. And a Class A misdemeanor has a fine up to $10,000 or imprisonment not exceeding 9 months. So, and again, the charging, of course, is up to the prosecutor, the DA, in each individual case. And they can look at the facts before them and make the appropriate charge.
All right. You've got a public hearing scheduled for tomorrow morning. You've had, I think, one already. What's been the response so far to this suggestion?
Response has been very good. We had a hearing in the Senate Transportation Committee about 2 weeks ago. Virtually all the testimony was in favor of it. We heard some very poignant stories from individuals who had had family members or friends killed, and the driver was charged with just a moving violation, received a slap on the wrist. And I think the Senate committee was very moved by that testimony.
We're talking to Dave Cieslewicz. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Bicycle Federation. And we're talking about a proposed new law that would up the penalties in some cases where drivers kill bicyclists, pedestrians, other people defined as vulnerable users.
What about you? Are you an avid cyclist or someone who's out crossing the streets a lot as part of your daily walk? Have you ever had a problem sharing the road with cars? And what do you think about having some tougher penalties in place? You can call and share your story at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
We're continuing our conversation now with Dave Cheslevich, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Bicycle Federation, talking about a proposed law that would up penalties in some cases where drivers, automobile drivers, injure or kill vulnerable users of Wisconsin's roadways, bicyclists, pedestrians, in some cases farmers and others.
What about you? Are you out on the roads on your bicycle a lot? Have you ever had a problem sharing the car, the road with cars? Have you felt unsafe? And do you think it's good that there could be stiffer penalties coming? The number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Sarah with us in Eau Claire. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I was just wondering if there's any concern that money might go away from, you know, maybe a civil case where perhaps the family of the deceased would have sued the driver, and if the driver has to pay money for these fines, they may not have as much money to pay for to the family in a civil case.
All right, thanks for the call, Sarah.
Well, of course, you know, the civil option is always open in addition to this, and I think that chances are, you know, a prosecutor would take all that into account. It has not been an issue that's been raised as this bill is being considered.
All right. We'll go now to Phil in Lake Mills. Phil, hi. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. Yeah, I support this legislation. I've personally known three people in the last 3 years who have been killed on their bicycles. And if you total up all the fines that the motorists receive, you couldn't buy a junker on Craigslist. That's my comment.
All right, Phil. And that's the kind of story that you're looking to change, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, Phil's story isn't all that uncommon. So many of us know someone who's been killed or seriously injured in one of these accidents. And, you know, our feeling is, and I think most people do agree with Phil, that the fines that these negligent motorists face just aren't commensurate with what has happened.
All right. Back to the phones now. We have Denise in Boscobel. Hi, Denise.
Hi. My question is, why would we consider farm equipment vulnerable and need to be protected? My experience has shown me that generally farm equipment doesn't follow the rules of the law. They drive at night without lights. They drive above posted rates in my area, and people that drive farm equipment at 45 miles an hour do not have driver's license. Thank you.
All right, so she's okay with the bike part, but not the farmers driving their farm equipment as vulnerable users under this bill, Dave.
Right. Well, I think some of the issues that the caller mentioned apply to bicyclists as well. If they're violating the rules of the road, then a citation is not likely to be issued in the first place. And if there's no citation, then there's no penalty enhancers.
All right. Thanks for the question. We have Dave with us in Milwaukee. Dave, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot. I have a question. I drive for my work, and I drive up to 1,000 miles a week. And numerous times I have been cut off by bicyclists. I have been sitting at stop signs where they, or stoplights, where they fly right by and pay no attention to the rules of the road. I'm wondering why we don't increase the fines on the bicyclists that are not following the rules, and then a car will hit them, and 99% of the time, the driver of the car will be blamed.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dave. Dave Cheslevich, do you think he's on target there?
Well, I think he's partially on target and partially off. We certainly agree at the Bike Fed that bicyclists should follow the rules of the road. As a matter of fact, most of what we do at the Bike Fed is educating kids and adults about how to bike safely. And the first thing we teach them is that they have to follow the rules of the road, and we teach them what those rules are. So I couldn't agree more with the caller that cyclists should follow the rules of the road, and they should use common sense. And certainly nothing irritates me more as the executive director of the Bike Fed than to see cyclists not doing that. So I share his concern there. However, just to get back to an earlier point I made, I do think that there is more responsibility that I take on when I'm driving a car than when I'm riding a bicycle, because when I'm driving a car, I'm in command of deadly force, which I am not on a bicycle. So that's the reason for the penalty enhancers going to the driver.
We'll go back to your calls in just a minute at 800-642-1234. Before we do, Dave, I wanted to get into a wider issue. I'm guessing you're hoping this law passes and is used rarely, if ever. Is the bigger message here how we get along on our roadways, whether we're driving, biking, walking, et cetera?
Sure, absolutely. It's great news for us that bicycling has really taken off in the last several years, but that means more bicyclists on the road. And the previous caller is correct. Cyclists need to pay attention. They need to follow the rules. But the same is true for car drivers. And unfortunately, we've had so many cases in the last several years in which drivers who have been inattentive, who have been reckless, careless, have made mistakes that have resulted in the death or serious injury of cyclists. And so this is one part of a much broader mission we have at the Bike Fed to try to keep everybody safe on the road.
All right, we'll go back to the phones now with Nick in Madison. Nick, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. See, I live on a busy street, and so the bicycles, they go on the sidewalks. And I do a lot of walking, and they'll run you over. I've seen people hurt bicycles. They almost get cut in two, and they call the ambulance for the pedestrians. What's the pedestrians' rights?
All right, Nick, thanks for the call. A little away from the law you're backing here, Dave, but do you want to address that?
Sure. So as a rule, it's not a good idea to mix bicyclists and pedestrians. I'm not sure about the ordinances in other cities, but here in Madison, you can ride a bike on a bicycle that doesn't have a zero lot line. So, for example, downtown, where buildings come right up to the sidewalk, you cannot ride a bicycle on that sidewalk. But here in my neighborhood on the Near West Side, you could. What's important is that we have the infrastructure in place so that cyclists feel comfortable in their lane on a street. The question I always ask when I see a cyclist on a sidewalk, even here in my neighborhood where it's legal, the question I always ask is, well, why is that cyclist there? Why does that cyclist not feel comfortable on the street? And so what we need to do is take a look at that and then make sure the correct infrastructure is in place. As a rule, and I'm a frequent cyclist myself, I don't want to ride on a sidewalk if I can avoid it for these very reasons. I don't want to mix it up with pedestrians. And so for the most part, cyclists don't want to be there. And so the question we need to ask as public policymakers is, why is that cyclist there and what can we do to accommodate that person on the street where they belong?
Quick thought, message on Facebook related, curious about bike infrastructure. They write, it's easier for road sharing in a place like Madison that's built for bikes. What about the rest of the state that doesn't have that?
Well, we hope that the rest of the state will be catching up. As a matter of fact, it is. You know, we have now, I think, over a dozen cities in the state of Wisconsin that are on the National League of American Bicyclists bicycle-friendly cities list. And so this is really picking up in the state. Milwaukee is on that list, Sheboygan County, Sturgeon Bay, La Crosse, I could go on. So communities are actually installing this infrastructure. Madison is maybe a bit ahead of some of the other communities, but they're catching up fast. And I think what we understand now is that to the extent that we can install this infrastructure where cyclists have a safe place to ride, that's going to be better for cyclists, it's going to be better for pedestrians, and it's going to be better for drivers.
Time for a quick call from Laura in Brookfield. Laura, hi. And Laura dropped off just as I was going to her. She said that she actually had been hit by a car as pedestrian. And Dave, I think she's backing up your message calling for more penalties. What do you think? Are you optimistic on the road ahead for this proposal in the legislature?
I'm pretty optimistic. We have great authorship. We have Senator Luther Olson
and Representative Gary Bees, two Republicans, one in the House, one in the Senate, who are main authors, but bipartisan authorship on this bill. The bill got a good hearing in the Senate. We thank Senator Petrovsky for holding that hearing. And we have a hearing, as you mentioned, coming up tomorrow in the Assembly at 10 a.m. In front of Representative Ripp's Transportation Committee, and Representative Ripp is a co-author of the bill. So, yeah, we're optimistic. Of course, you never know when it comes to the legislation exactly what's going to happen, but right now we're feeling pretty good about it.
All right, Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dave Cieslewicz, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Bicycle Federation.
Coming up next is Wisconsin Public Radio News, and then our guest says it's time to make death a part of our life. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickards.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest wants us to embrace our mortality and everything that goes with it. Her mission is to teach us to accept death as a natural part of life and the extinction of our bodies and personalities as a part of the process, and it doesn't need to terrorize us.
Caitlin Doty is a licensed mortician and funeral director and the founder of the Order of the Good Death. She writes, produces, and stars in the popular web series called Ask a Mortician. Caitlin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you write that your work is about teaching people to make death a part of their life. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that I happen to believe, as other people do, that death is kind of the most fundamental relationship that you'll ever have in your life. Whether or not we're directly engaging with it, it really is a force that affects our personality, affects our subconscious mind, and the more that we can bring it out into the open and figure out what our relationship is with death at any given time, the more self-aware a person we are.
Now, is it a personal thing? Everyone's relationship to death is different?
Yeah, absolutely. Just like everyone's relationship to their husband or wife or children is their own specific relationship. So you can't have a blanket thing that's going to work for everyone. But the more things that you, the more conversations you have, the more that people can figure out what their own unique relationship is with death. And it will change over time. My relationship with death is different every day.
What is it like today?
Today, well, I'm in Los Angeles, and it's very sunny, and I got some work done this morning, so I'm feeling like I have my life together. So my relationship with death is very positive today.
Well, I know you've studied the history of death. You've cremated bodies. You've driven the van that has the bodies. You've done a lot and been really hands-on in this. You're a licensed mortician, and I wonder, you know, you're very comfortable with death, it sounds like. Most of America, I think, is probably not, and you say this as well. Did we used to be more comfortable with the idea of death than we are now?
We used to be a lot more comfortable, and the reason for that is that we used to have a lot more dead bodies around us. We used to have a lot more death and dying. So we had the dying process actually took place in the whole home, which now it's largely in either hospitals or in nursing homes. And then after the person died, they would be kept in the home for several days being taken care of by the family. And keep in mind that in the 1700s, 1800s, 1900s, even early 1900s, people were dying at a much higher rate than we are now. There can be people now who are 40, 50 years old who have never even been to a funeral or seen a dead body. So we used to have a much more intimate relationship with death just because it was happening much more frequently and it was much closer to us.
When the body was sitting in the home and people were caring for it, the family, the loved ones, was that still kind of a ghoulish thing? Did people see it that way, or was it something different that we don't maybe have a category for now?
Yeah, I would say that's correct. It's this place in between life and death. I mean, there were still absolutely superstitions, you know, covering the mirrors and things like that to keep the line between the living and the dead secure. And they would actually, the name wake, which we now know is visiting the body after the death has occurred, actually comes from the fear that the body would wake up.
Wow.
So, and that it wasn't quite dead, and you had to make sure that the body is dead. So in the way we've medicalized death, we've brought it into the medical field much more. And in that way, that actually makes us cleaner with deaths, and we know that a dead body is a dead body, but we don't have that really physical, tangible, normal relationship with just having the dead body around that we used to. So there are pros and cons to the new system.
Now, is that the main reason you say that we got so distanced from the death process in America?
I think so. I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think the professionalization, either in the medical field or in the funeral field, in the funeral directors and mortuaries, that sort of took death out of the home and said, oh, there are professionals. Dead bodies can be dangerous. Professionals should be the ones to handle this, which is not actually really true. Normal, every you or I, anybody can really take care of a dead body. It's not a skill that requires a great deal of, and funeral directors disagree with me on this, but the facts are that you don't really need a funeral director to take care of a dead body.
I want to talk a little bit about the American funeral, because right now it seems to be, you know, makeup, embalming, an open casket funeral where people can come and see, you know, someone, a body that looks an awful lot like the person that they loved, maybe not quite. What do you make of that kind of American funeral?
Well, I think that there's something a little uncanny valley about the embalmed body, because you're right, it looks like the person, but it doesn't look quite like them, and the embalming can kind of make them look a little waxen, and the makeup is a little strange, and the suit is a little strange, because you know that they're dead, and you know that they're beginning to decompose, and there's just sort of a strangeness to it, which is why I think it's kind of better to see corpses as they really are. Corpses, a dead corpse as a dead corpse, and that's the reality of the situation, and that can be kind of harsh for people who aren't used to it. But people all around the world and Americans before the last 75 years were very used to seeing dead bodies as they actually were.
How did you get so comfortable with this? I mean, this isn't something that most of us like to think about, let alone, you know, engage in every day.
Right. Well, I was interested in death academia for a long time. I studied medieval history and medieval death rituals in college. And then when I got out of college, I wanted to see if I could actually work with real dead bodies and see if there was some place between theory and the real work of death. And what's really made me so comfortable is combining those things, working with dead bodies for so long and just being able to, you know, none of them have ever reached up and grabbed my hand. None of them have ever struck terror into my heart. None of them have ever, they're very beautiful shells where the, you know, soul or whatever it is that you believe animates a person is clearly left the building. And it is what, that's why we call them the body of the remains. It is what remains. And it's a really beautiful thing. And it's, I wouldn't say I enjoy being around dead bodies, but I do in a way, because they bring me comfort and they remind me of where I will be, which causes me to reflect on my own life.
Wow, I'm really struck by what you said, beautiful shells. I would never think of calling, you know, even a loved one's body beautiful, because it's, you know, I guess I'd like to see the beauty in it. How do you think we can get there?
I think by, and this is something that I say, that when you go to a typical American funeral, especially where in the Midwest, where it's kind of the traditions are still the strongest, where you have the body and it's embalmed and it's made up and you only go in for about an hour or so, or you just file past the casket once and get a glimpse in, and it's grandfather or mother, and it's a little strange, and you leave going, I don't know if I want that for myself, that was a little weird, is a very different experience than actually being with a body for a couple of days, or being with a body after it dies, the way that we used to have bodies in the home. So the longer that you are actually with a body, the more that you can start to think about bigger issues, the more that you can think about what your relationship with the person who died was, the more that you can allow yourself to see the beauty in the situation and the beauty in the fact that we will all eventually die.
Is there a best way to have a wake or a funeral, a way that you, based on your experience, consider the most natural?
Well, there's no best way, because again, you know, me saying this is what I believe is totally different than, you know, in Papua New Guinea, they think that we should take them out every couple of years and mummify them and redress them. You know, so there's so many different ways to see a corpse, I guess. But for me, what I found is that keeping the body, if possible, and I know that if the body died in an accident or there was some messy, longer illness, it's difficult to keep a body in the home after the person died. But if the person was on hospice, for instance, and if you've been caring for them in the home, there's no reason that you can't keep them in the home for about 48 hours after after they've passed away, and just give yourself a chance to sit with the body and to realize that they're gone and to realize that things are fundamentally different. Things have shifted. A person who was part of your life is no longer a part of your life, and give yourself a chance to really sit with that.
Well, so then how do you feel about cremation? It seems like that's something that's trending now, and the idea is that it's, I guess, people seem to feel like it's cleaner, and if they don't like the formaldehyde and the open casket thing, this seems like an option that people are embracing. What do you think about cremation?
Well, since I live in California, we really are, especially Southern California, really is a cremation culture. Our cremation rates are very high here. It's approaching 50% countrywide. They say that in the next 10 years, it will be 50% across the country. And I've worked a lot in cremation. And I think that cremation can be good. I think, again, that, you know, cremating or burning a body is just as valid as burying a body, as long as, again, there's that interaction with the reality of death. So somewhere I see a problem is in something called direct cremation. And what direct cremation is just the funeral home picks up the body, takes it away, the family doesn't see it, the body is cremated, and the ashes are returned. And so you hear someone's dying, and then the next thing you see is their box of ashes, box of cremated remains. And I think that there is an issue in that because it doesn't really engage with the reality of death either. So I think, you know, burial or even embalming or cremation is fine. Whatever you want to do is fine as long as you're also giving yourself that real tangible interaction with the death.
Let's take one of our callers. We have Annie on the line from New Berlin. Hello, Annie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that we did a very hands-on thing. I went through hospice detox, who are excellent, and I knew the Amish did not go through a funeral home, so I knew there was a way to do it. So I must stress, you must do the paperwork ahead. But basically, my husband had pancreatic cancer. We didn't act together, so we were 24/7 for years, and I was losing not only my partner but my life. And it really helped me not only to be his caregiver and all of that, but at the end, I did have two male friends that put him in the body bag for me. But he laid in state here at home after he died. I was with him when he died. And then we had built the coffin ahead, and it was very personal. You know, I put parts of the horse, I cut off pieces of the horse's tail and everything. And we had six people come over and help me carry the body, and we put it in the, but we laid them in state for, you have to have them for 48 hours before you cremate them. And we, then we took the coffin, and I have a big pickup, so we put it in the back of that, and I was afraid it would rain. So as I drove down to the barn, I had made everybody that came over a drink. We all kind of went down to the barn and were with the horses and everything, and we kind of had a wake there. In another way, you know, and then we all took a Sharpie and signed that he used to autograph with, and we signed the coffin. And I dealt directly with the cremation service, so I drove the body there. You know, actually, you have to wait 48 hours, and he passed after the closing hours, so we had to wait till the next morning after the time was up. But it was incredibly personal, and I just want to say how wonderful it was, and it was his wishes instead of, I just didn't want, my mother, when they came to take her away because she died in the home, it was so impersonal, and this was so much, it's still terrible and hard, but it's much more closure, I feel.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Annie, and Annie taking a very personal route. What do you think about what Annie did, Caitlin?
Well, I think it's wonderful. I think she's kind of the poster child for what I would like to advocate for, and I'd love to talk to her more. I think she made two really good points. One is that to do this kind of thing, because it's new, it's old, but it's new as far as the modern bureaucracy and how we usually do things now, you do really have to plan ahead. You do really have to be sure exactly what you want, because it's easy to fall when somebody actually dies and it's terrible and it's sad. It's easy to fall into, oh, shoot, I better just, you know, go the traditional route and not do what we had planned and not do what we had talked about. So definitely make sure that you have the paperwork and you have everything that you want to do in mind before. And the other good point is that I've really yet to hear anybody who does this kind of thing and really does it themselves say, oh, it was a terrible experience. It was grotesque being with the body. Dead bodies are scary. I would never do it again. I've actually never heard anybody say that. about what she's talking about. So I think that was a beautiful story, and I'm glad that she was able to do it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Annie. We're talking right now with Caitlin Doty. She's a licensed mortician and funeral director and the founder of the Order of the Good Death. She writes, produces, and stars in the popular web series called Ask a Mortician.
And the door's open for your questions. If you want to know what happens to the body at death, what your options are, or if you want to share your story as Annie did, you can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett.
We're talking about death and how we think about it in America and why we tend to be in denial about death. Our guest says we need to embrace it as a natural part of life. Caitlin Doty is a licensed mortician, and she writes, produces, and stars in the web series Ask a Mortician.
You can join the show with your questions and your experiences at 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And Caitlin, you've done a lot of research into all the different aspects of burial. What are some that we don't know about here in America?
Well, probably one that you don't know about is something called green or natural burial, although you might. It's really gaining in popularity, although there tend to be a lot of, I guess, trend pieces about it, which make it seem like it's kind of a fad as opposed to the way that humans have been buried for thousands of years. So what it is burying a body just straight in the ground in a shroud or in a decomposable casket, just straight in the actual earth, as opposed to what most cemeteries require, which is a heavy-duty casket and a concrete vault around it underground, which really kind of keeps us from decomposing and going back into nature as we might naturally do.
Can you do that in, you know, a regular cemetery, or can you do it anywhere in your backyard?
Well, it depends on where you live. Backyard burial is a little tricky. Definitely not if you live in a larger city. It's much more difficult. But if you live in a rural area, it's really going to be up to sort of the local county or municipality as to the rules for that. Having more acreage definitely helps. But you have to remember that, especially in our modern world, people move a lot. It's hard to sell a house that has your father buried on the land. Mm-hmm. So definitely it's possible to do that. Cemeteries, the big vaults and everything that are traditional cemeteries, are people think that it's state law. It's not state law. It's a thing that cemeteries do because they don't like the way that the ground shifts, because they have to mow it, and it saves them money to be able to have big vaults underground. They also make money from selling the big vaults underground. So if people don't demand natural burial and they don't ask for it, there's not a lot of incentive for cemeteries to move forward with creating either natural burial sections or dedicated natural burial cemeteries. There are definitely some. I Googled this, and if you Google natural burial or green burial Wisconsin, you will find some things and places that are expanding in that way.
Huh, interesting. Okay, let's go to the calls now. We've got Joe on the line from Waterloo, Iowa. Hi, Joe.
Hi. My stepmother is an old German farm girl from central Iowa. She has a great story. Maybe 30 years ago, one of her cousins died, big extended family. The family was going past the casket and in the viewing, and one of her aunts picked up the guy's hand and shook it and said, "Goodbye, old pal," and put it down and walked on. Hmm. And the family actually thought it was more just a faux pas. And it's just they all loved her. She was great. And it wasn't a big deal. But to touch the body was not a problem in that culture.
Interesting. Caitlin?
Yeah, well, my family is actually from Iowa as well, so my hat's off to her. There's kind of been a narrative in the past 75 to 100 years, which is that dead bodies are dangerous somehow, that you don't touch them, that you're going to catch diseases or deadness from them, and that's really just not true. There's nothing that a dead body could give you that a living body couldn't give you. And in fact, you're much less likely to catch something from a dead body than you are a living body, because most viruses die very quick, or any bacteria die very quickly in the body. And the bacteria that does cause decomposition and the things that we think of as a little gross are not things that make you sick. Bacteria doesn't make you sick in that way, unless you're consuming the dead body, which you are most likely not.
All right. Well, thank you for that story. Appreciate that. And we'll move next to Jim in Fairchild. Hi, Jim.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You actually answered part of my question, but I guess both of my parents are buried above ground in a vault. And as a former science teacher and a person with a degree in biology, I find that kind of peculiar and unnatural and wasteful that these people aren't, all these bodies aren't being recycled, as it were. And I just was wondering, you know, do these people that are involved, do they eventually decompose?
Yeah, they do. They do eventually decompose, but it's a little strange because the embalming chemicals that go through the circulatory system, what they do is they fix the proteins, and that's what slows down the decomposition for embalming. And so the body will eventually decompose, but the skin tends to be a little firmer and last a little longer. So it kind of, the body will become a little soupy on the inside, not to be too graphic for your listeners. And then it has kind of a mummified look a little bit, especially if the embalming wasn't done incredibly well for long-term preservation. But I agree. I think that the body, you know, many of us consume animals throughout our lives. And I think it's kind of poetic to, when we die, just go back into the ground so they can then eat us. And the cycle continues on.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call, Jim. And Caitlin, I know something that you advocate for is that we need to teach kids in school about death. We should be teaching them about sex education and death education. What would that be like? Would that sort of, you know, get around the freak out factor that seems to set in for a lot of us by the time we hit adulthood?
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's a good saying that says talking about sex won't make you pregnant and talking about dying won't make you dead. So, you know, sex and death are these two huge cultural forces and physical forces that we deal with every day. And, you know, you don't have to teach either of them as doctrine. You know, you're not saying, you know, go out and have sex. You're not saying go out and be, you know, a complete macabre weirdo. What you're just saying is, hey, these are very natural things that exist. Here are the facts about them. How you choose to engage with them is how you choose to engage them with them, 16-year-old. But I think starting that early is a way to create really well-rounded, well-informed people who can use those tools to apply to other things as well.
We've only got about 30, 40 seconds left, but I want to ask you, there's a line from Six Feet Under. I'm sure you know about the show. It takes place in a funeral home, and one character asks, why do people have to die? And the other one says, to make life important or something like that. And how would you answer that question? Why do people have to die?
I'd say same. It's if we lived forever, there would be no motivation to achieve or to get married or to have children or to write books. All the things that we do are motivated by the knowledge that our life is finite.
And is that a good thing, a good knowledge that you have?
Yeah, it's a great knowledge. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Caitlin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Caitlin Doty, a licensed mortician, funeral director, founder of the Order of the Good Death. And she writes, produces, and stars in the web series called Ask a Mortician.
Coming up, a history of the panic and the pleasure behind candy, just in time for Halloween. This is Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.